Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Code word I did remember. Onions. That word had been allowed in our correspondence to represent discreetly our passion. Love became onions, even the act itself.
Hello there, it's N. Quentin Wolfe here. I'm just getting ready to record this week's Londonist Out Loud. And to aid me as I do so, I'm listening to Graham Greene's The End of the Affair. It's an unabridged audiobook. You'll never guess where I get it from. Yes, audible.co.uk. They're our sponsors and they're up for giving you a free audiobook of exactly this sort from their catalogue of over 60,000 digital audiobooks. All you've got to do to claim yours, which you can download and keep forever, and you can burn to CD or keep as an MP3, whatever you prefer, is sign up for their 30-day free trial with the Audible service. Stay on with the Audible service, of course, and you'll get audiobooks on a regular basis, but you don't have to, and you'll still be able to keep your book whatever you do. To claim your free audiobook, just go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
But there still remains jealousy of my rival. A melodramatic word, painfully inadequate to express the unbearable complacency, confidence.
London, Michaelmas term lately over.
London? Okay, you know where you are.
A radical transformation.
Very radical transformation.
People are morally outraged with what's going on.
I got very excited this week.
Seemed reasonable, didn't it?
As soon as you scratch the surface, you realise gore happened all across London. Every open square
really
would have a gallery.
Place called the Kittle Hoosie. Saw ye Geordie's Grace riding on a goosey.
What the hell is that?
When a man is tired of London, he's tired of
so
life.
So what was the first thing that caught your eye?
The South has an overstuffed walrus.
It's very important history.
A handwritten letter from Charles Dickens.
There's a piece of information we're missing here somewhere.
You snake through the city, immersing yourself in the sights, sounds,
for the Jewish community, who came over in their tens of thousands from Russia, from Poland.
We are doing a modern take on Morris dancing.
When did he think the Second Coming was going to happen?
Yes, Boris. He wants to put an airport.
the tone with which Boris has announced that is fatigue.
Yes, the city is always changing. People frequently say to me, you know, won't it be wonderful when it's finished? And I say, no, it'll be dreadful. It'll mean it's dead.
Inform and entertain, that's what it's about.
London is a modern Babylon.
That's very true.
Can we have some of the detail here? Hello, it's Friday, March the 8th, 2013. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud, a podcast of news, views and curiosities from London, UK. You can download the show free on iTunes, hook up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, tweet me at Londonist Sound, or check out images of our guests via Londonist Out Loud on Instagram. Well, we're all about the railways today, the railways nationally and the railways in London. I'll be discussing with Gareth Edwards from London Reconnections, one of the darkest chapters in London and indeed the country's rail history. Before that, though, you may remember in last week's episode, we poked with a stick the question of what happens to all the newspapers that get left behind on, particularly on the underground, I think, but also on overground and other forms of transport. We've been in touch with Transport for London about this, and they have sent us, I think, a fairly standard reply outlining what they do as far as recycling goes. Thanks to Matt Keane, who also followed up on this and produced a similar result. This looks like the cookie cutter response that comes out. And whilst it's great that TfL is addressing recycling, I have to say the response falls perhaps a little short. of what might be hoped for. As far as the London Underground, they say most of London Underground's station and depot waste goes to recycling centres, which can separate these materials and send them for recycling. So that's the station and the depots. 70% of those station and depot waste products are recycled. However, we do recycle approximately half of all waste left on the underground by focusing on recycling when we clean our trains. And they go on to say, at these stations, newspapers are collected separately from general waste. The cleaners use clear plastic bags and the material is sent for recycling. 50%, okay, maybe that's not as good as it could be, I would have thought. Particularly when you consider, I mean, just the next time you're in a tube carriage, have a little look up and down and see what that waste is mostly made up of. Well, from my experience, most of that stuff is recyclable, so I'm quite surprised at that response. I also must say that the idea of cleaners going around with clear plastic bags that separately collect the newspapers, which is kind of the image that I realised I wasn't seeing when this whole question started, they're telling us that that's what happens, but I must say that doesn't marry up with my personal experience. Well, I don't know, perhaps what I was seeing was unrepresentative. Where other forms of transport are concerned, though, it's much hazier. And by and large, TfL is pointing at other organisations and saying, well, you know, this is down to these guys. They do so with local authorities. They mention the local authorities are responsible for collecting rubbish outside stations. They talk about how recycling schemes have been trialled and have fallen flat on their face because people have been putting food waste in there. Some of the phrases here simply seem to relate to assurances given to TfL by other organisations. For example, on the DLR, it says recycling bins are not permitted on the DLR due to security restrictions. However, newspapers left on trains will be recycled by the cleaners at the depot. Well, okay, if they say so. This, for me, though, in the section under buses, this scanned information under the buses section here, and it suggests that the majority of newspapers are taken with passengers or left on buses, which tells us very little about the recycling. It goes on to say, London buses have been given assurance from bus operators that recycling at depots and garages is taking place. Well, I mean, you could drive a bus through that, couldn't you? Where our specific question about the newspapers left on the tube is concerned, though, they say London Underground has worked with London's free newspaper distributors to have a newspaper campaign that promoted help us to recycle by taking your newspaper with you. Is that really recycling? Or is that just not leaving the stuff there in the first place? We didn't see, says TfL, any significant drop in the amount of waste collected. But the amount of waste collected did level off, having increased steadily in previous years. However, this may be related to certain free newspapers being withdrawn at the same time. So an ingenious approach to recycling there from London Underground, including getting people not to leave the newspapers on the tube in the first place, and essentially just waiting for the newspapers to close down.
Three trains were involved in the appalling railway disaster at Harrow and Wealdstone. Each was full of people, and the station was also crowded, with the result that British Railways have suffered their worst accident.
Well, normally on this podcast, we make every effort to avoid recording in certain places. Snow is bad. It makes a lot of noise when a car goes through snow. And train lines are particularly bad, but we're purposely next to the train line today, and that's because we will be talking about a major moment in the rail history of both the capital and the country. Here with me is Gareth Edwards. He's a transport journalist and historian, and he is the editor of London Reconnections.
Hello.
Hello, hello. What is London Reconnections, first of all?
London Reconnections is a site where we kind of cover the news about London transport in depth, kind of the greater depth than you get in, say, the kind of the papers, and also the history of London and its railways and buses and everything else.
What about the train side of things? It sounds as though you might have a specialism there over other modes of transport. I'm not sure.
London rail history is for my sins something I've studied quite a lot of, and certainly kind of in and around kind of the major events. So things like kind of the disaster that we're here to discuss today and various other things.
Yes, I should probably preface this by saying that if younger ears are listening, or even more sensitive ears, there may be things to hear here which people find disturbing, because we are going to be talking, as you say, about a major disaster that happened, and we're going back for this to 1952, Harrow and Wealdstone. and it is the Harrow and Wealdstone rail crash that we're talking about. Perhaps we could set a bit of a scene and maybe draw in for people who are less familiar with how the train system was working then.
I mean, the era we're in is kind of the classic steam era, the kind of you remember from kind of the films of steam trains everywhere, and really the kind of peak of that. I mean, we're just into the post-war period. Steam is still a major force in UK rail, and it's pretty much been perfected. So it is really that kind of that cinematic era of large kind of engines powering through the countryside and the cities.
Oh yes, think Brief Encounter and those scary moments where the train comes through with its whistle on.
Yeah, exactly that kind of thing.
Okay, so we're in Harrow and Wealdstone. It's what time of year in 1956?
We're into October, so we're into the kind of the autumn period, and that really actually plays part of the kind of disaster. We're into the cold mornings, frosty breath, fog on the railway, that kind of thing. To set the scene, it's a foggy morning. Harrow and Wealdstone is a kind of, if for those not familiar with the station, it's a relatively small station just kind of to the north of London. If you imagine any station that you're familiar with, you've got tracks going in different directions. And it services both kind of express trains that are kind of running down to Euston from Scotland, and also local passenger services that take people to work in the morning. And on this particular October morning, what happens is that you have a passenger train coming in from Tring. It's heading into Euston, and it's stopping at all the stations on the way in. It's very busy. In actual fact, as is still the case today, there was problems on the railway, and the train before had been cancelled, so it was even busier than normal. And as it was stopping at Harrow Station, at Harrow and Wealdstone Station, an express train that was powering down from Perth to Euston didn't stop. It missed all its signals, and it ran straight into the back of the Tring train. Worse, unfortunately, at exactly the same time as this happened, on the other line, a fast train to Manchester and Liverpool was coming up, and it ploughed straight into the wreckage that had poured from the other track and kind of landed in its way.
So we've got the fast train coming up behind train number one. Train number two slams into the back of it, comes off the tracks and onto the opposing track, and then a third train. And the other train was coming at quite a speed, I think, this third train that then hit the front of the second train.
Yeah, I mean, both the trains that were kind of moving at the time were really kind of powering through. I mean, express is not just a word. If you imagine when you found yourself standing on a station and one of those kind of trains powers through at kind of 60, 70 miles an hour, and the feeling that you get as you're told to stand behind the yellow line, that was the speed these trains were going at. You've effectively got two accidents rolled into one. You've got this train moving at 70 miles an hour that hits a stationary train in the platform, and then as the wreckage of that is on the other line, another train running at the same speed hits it as well.
We don't have to imagine the carnage, because there's plenty of photographic evidence of the aftermath of this incident. We've been looking through some of the pictures just before recording, and they make for grisly viewing. Within a moment you can see that it would be remarkable if anybody walked away from this mess. It's pretty much impossible to work out how many trains there are from some of the pictures.
Yes, I mean, because of the speed these trains are travelling at, and because the carriages were made largely of wood at this time, what happens is the last three carriages of the stopped passenger train are effectively concertinaed down into the length of one carriage, and the wood kind of explodes outwards, and you get this kind of mass of millions of small splinters just flying down the train. You end up with this kind of big hulk of twisted wreckage. Witnesses kind of describe the sound as this kind of roar and scream of twisted metal, and it really kind of evokes the kind of the horror there must have been on that day.
We'll be talking about one very particular figure who emerged as a result of this disaster. Before we talk about that, though, what's the precedent for a rail disaster on this sort of scale in London?
In London, you don't really have much in the way of that kind of scale. I mean, ultimately, 112 people die in the Harrow and Wealdstone rail crash, and that actually makes it the largest civilian rail disaster that the UK has ever seen and will ever see, hopefully. The actual kind of the general predecessor for it is actually in Scotland. That's actually in 1915. You have to go back to 1915 to kind of find something on that similar scale, and that's actually at Quinton's Hill, and that's actually over 200 people die there. But that's a military train. That's during the kind of the First World War and the troop movements, and two trains crash into each other, and there's a big fire, and lots of people die in that. But, I mean, really, Harrow and Wealdstone is kind of unprecedented in the scale, that both at the time and since. We've had nothing since then.
The clock stopped at the time of the crash. While the Train to Euston train was standing in the station, the night express from Perth ran into it, causing fearful damage and chaos. Then the Euston to Manchester express collided with the wreckage from the first collision. The scene has been described by an eyewitness as being like a battlefield. Certainly no exaggeration, for casualties were on a terrible scale.
If there can be said to be a bit of luck on that day, then the luck took the form of military personnel being present.
Yes, I mean, one of the kind of the things with Harrow is, and why it leaves such a kind of legacy as an accident, is that there's actually several incidents of pure chance that actually come in and end up saving lives. Standing outside the station at the time on his motorbike is a police officer. That police officer is riding the only motorcycle in the entire area that is equipped with a radio, and instantly is able to radio back to base and call for help. So the police are there very promptly. Ambulances are dispatched. There's a big kind of impact in that regard. Similarly, Harrow Town Hall is actually right next to the station. At the very moment that the trains crash, Harrow's kind of civil defence and crisis committee are holding a meeting to discover whether they should carry on and still exist or whether they should disband. So actually the council workers, who are all kind of responsible for rescue and everything, also are literally metres away when it happens. And more crucially, on the train itself, there are four members of the US Air Force, and they actually are members of a medical unit of the US Air Force, the 494th Medical Group, that happens to be stationed at South Ruislip at the time. They very quickly kind of realized the scale of the kind of the accident and the number of victims around, and they ask an offer to call in help from their medical base from South Ruislip. And that's what happens. A team of doctors and one nurse are kind of sent up frantically from the brand new top of the range US Air Force hospital at South Ruislip, and they quickly kind of respond and come to the scene.
Yes, it should be remembered, of course, that we're still just a few years after the end of the Second World War. There's still quite a militarised sense in the country. We're still on rationing and all that stuff. And, of course, a lot of Americans still based in the UK.
Yeah, and, I mean, even for kind of Britain, I mean, we're kind of used to it now, but it's worth remembering that the NHS at this point is only 4 years old. So ambulances and ambulance services and everything else have only really just come into the public sphere, and also, at this point, are only just starting to be kind of coordinated as a whole and not kind of operated on a hospital by hospital basis.
We should say something about what the American medical team did once they were on the ground.
The team was under the command of an officer called Lieutenant Colonel Wiedemann. And he was a very senior doctor. He'd seen service in France. He'd very much been on the battlefront. And his assessment when he arrived with his kind of team of seven doctors and nurse was very much to kind of turn round and say that it resembled more a battlefield than it did an accident, and that very much coloured his kind of treatment and how he approached treating patients there. When he arrived, there was a certain amount of organised chaos. There were doctors there that had come from the locality. Ambulances had turned up. The walking wounded had been thrown into those ambulances and taken to hospital. And now there's a certain amount of chaos because as more wounded people were being pulled out with serious injuries, there were no ambulances to take them to hospital. All those ambulances had departed and they hadn't come back again yet. So you had this kind of element of chaos. People using, there's records that show they were using kind of removal vans to get people to hospital and everything else. And Wiedemann kind of looked at this and effectively started to take a certain amount of charge. The big thing that Wiedemann does and his team do is they actually set up a combat aid station on platform 5 and 6 at Harrow and Wealdstone station. And they start triaging patients. As they come out, they kind of do that thing that today we're kind of familiar with from kind of series like MASH, from kind of even things like, you know, if you watch Grey's Anatomy or something like that, you see them do it as people come into the hospital in these accidents. You work out who are the most badly wounded, you treat them on the scene, and then you take them to hospital. But in 1952, this was virtually unknown. It had been used in combat for two world wars by now, but in a civilian setting, it didn't happen. And Wiedemann's team do that at Harrow. They turn around and they set up their medical station. They start triaging patients. They start treating the really seriously wounded on the platform before they get taken to hospital.
Well, we are indebted to John Hodson, who first brought this story to the attention of Londonist Out Loud, and he did so by mentioning the figure who now makes her presence felt on the scene. So thank you, John, for alerting us to Abby Sweetwine and her role in proceedings. Who was it, Abby Sweetwine?
Well, as I mentioned kind of at the beginning, when the American medical team responded, there were seven doctors in that ambulance that came down, and there was one nurse. Abby Sweetwine was the one nurse. She was a nursing lieutenant in the 494th, and whilst the doctors were treating people, it fell to Abby to kind of really manage the kind of the chaos and the kind of the wounded that were coming in into their aid station on the platform. She was responsible for doing the triage on these patients, for seeing who needed checking. She used a tube of lipstick she happened to have on her to mark who'd been given morphine, who'd been treated, all this information that would later save lives in the hospital, and generally acting as a kind of a figurehead of kind of calm and safety in the chaos. She distributed tea and cigarettes, you know, to wounded and shocked passengers. And she became such a kind of icon of this that she became known as the Angel of Platform 6. It was a nickname that the Daily Mirror later gave her. And she really kind of personally made a huge difference at that time.
Now, of course, the one detail that hasn't emerged in the story so far is that of Abby Sweetwine's ethnicity.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the things that really marks out Harrow as a landmark, is that Abby Sweetwine is African American. She is possibly the only African American serving in the UK in the medical corps at the time, and by pure chance, she is the person who kind of responds as a nurse with Wiedemann's team. And at the time, I mean, it's really kind of important to remember the context here. You know, we're only a couple of years after the kind of the arrival of the Windrush in the UK. On a cultural level, the kind of there's not a huge kind of presence of kind of Caribbean and kind of certainly even amongst the American troops, of Afro-American troops in the UK. So she really kind of becomes a figure early on. She does a job, she does her job very well, and it changes minds. You can see that it kind of starts to change minds on a very local level. Often kind of things of issues of race are often come down to kind of unfamiliarity more than they do any kind of level of kind of dislike. And for a lot of people that day, kind of Abby's kind of just calm and collected behavior and doing her job, it's clear it changes a lot of minds.
I don't know if this is possible without documents in front of us, standing as we are by a chilly railway line, but are you able to recall any of the details of people's responses to her?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite hard kind of looking back in the past, as remote as we are from this event now, that a lot of the people kind of who are involved are obviously, you know, long deceased. But if you dig back through the kind of the local papers at the time, you dig back through your local gazettes and chronicles and things like that, you really start to build up a picture. And that picture shows that, you know, you see Abby being given the kind of the keys to Croxley Green Village and things like that. And you know that those are things that would not really have, they're not areas that would have encountered a lot of kind of diversity or anything like that, and it must have been a huge thing for those areas. It must have been a very big thing to kind of to start just put some doubt in people's minds as to the way they were treating people, or the way the world was working.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because this, of course, was pre the 60s civil rights movement in the US and so forth. So this really is very, very early on in the sort of cultural racial melting together of London. I don't know whether we've achieved that melting together even now.
Well, I think that's the thing. I mean, I think she's almost a kind of forgotten early hero of that kind of thing, certainly to me, because I think we kind of tend to focus on the big memories of things like, you know, in the 60s, on our Martin Luther Kings, on the big movements, and they were undoubtedly important. But so often, and it's the small acts, it's the small people just doing things that must have been hard for them to do on a regular basis. I mean, Abby Sweetwine was African American and she was a woman, and both of those things at that time in her job must have been incredibly hard to deal with, and yet she leaves this kind of huge legacy in, you know, that is forgotten today but is important.
Well, that's interesting that you say that. Yeah, she's certainly left a legacy in the fabric of our society. There's no doubt about that. What about direct commemoration of Abby Sweetwine?
I mean, there's not a huge amount out there. I mean, rail disasters are always a funny thing. they tend to live on in the kind of the cultural memory of a generation and sometimes beyond. But the railways themselves are never particularly good at commemorating disasters. They investigate them, they learn from them. But what they're no one really wants to kind of to build big landmarks of these things. If you find yourself in Harrow today, outside Harrow and Wilson Station, there's a plaque that commemorates kind of the events of that day. And last year was the 60th anniversary, and Harrow Council put on quite a lot of kind of events to commemorate it. And then at that event, there was quite a lot of mention of Abby Sweetwine and work, and I was involved with that, and we tried to find kind of some of her descendants to come down, but unfortunately it proved impossible. Abby died in 2009.
As recently as that?
Yeah, she lived to, I think, about 85 in the end. She stayed in the Army, in the Air Force, rather, nursing, up until, I think, 1969. She eventually attained the rank of Major. Unfortunately, Abby herself fell victim, to a certain extent, to the prejudices of the time, and ultimately left nursing in the US Air Force at that point, because she found she couldn't get higher. Major was about as far as she could get at that time. But today, I believe kind of her niece has ended up going into nursing as well, so that there's a familial kind of continuation of the thing. At the time of her death, one of her local papers over in America ran a kind of small obituary, and you can see it, you can find that online. And one of the kind of the comments in there that her niece leaves is that Abby told her that the important thing about nursing is to remember that you're doing it because of the feeling of how you feel inside, and to make a difference, not to be remembered. So I think, to a certain extent, I think Abby would be quite happy with not having a large commemoration of some kind.
I think that you may well be the authority on this subject, the Harrow and Wealdstone crash and the personages who were involved in it. How has that come about?
There's an old historian joke, which is slightly morbid, but is that you eventually become an expert on something when everyone else who is better than you passes away, and sadly that's almost certainly the case with Harrow. A lot of the kind of the research and everything into the disaster happened in kind of the 60s and 70s, and really it's been kind of forgotten, as I say, in a modern sense. So it wasn't really until kind of I started looking into it, and others since, that it's really kind of come to the fore again. So yes, I mean, sadly, I suspect at the moment, at least, I'm kind of the voice on the disaster, which is both a blessing and a curse as a historian.
Thinking of how some of the other rail disasters in particular are remembered around town, we think, of course, of the clock in King's Cross Station. And it's true where you mentioned that train companies are perhaps a little bit reluctant to remember those things publicly. It's true, whenever you walk past that clock, there is a little beat in your heart there that is certainly unwelcome, and you think what happened on that spot, and that, God knows, that's been an unlucky station in many ways. But a much bigger commemoration exists in the East End, the Bethnal Green Tube Disaster Memorial, quite an imposing brutalist sort of upside down staircase. What do you think has made that disaster remembered over some of the others that have taken place, for example Ladbroke Grove or Clapham Junction or those sorts of things?
I think often memory of these kind of events and commemoration often comes down to kind of two things. Timing is important. Bethnal Green Tube disaster obviously happened during Second World War, so it's tied in with that story as much as anything else. It's part of the kind of the London Blitz, and kind of the later mini Blitz, the small Blitz. It's tied in with those events. Similarly, I think often it comes down to really kind of generational and geographical memory, and Bethnal Green has quite a strong kind of geographical and cultural memory. It was noticeable at the kind of the Harrow commemoration events in last year that there are very few survivors left alive now, and so to a certain extent, because Harrow happens in this post-war world, in this transition where we're moving from kind of wartime, still very much as operating in wartime mode, we're moving from that into kind of the modern era with television, with everything else. Harrow is actually the first rail accident ever covered by a TV crew, or rather a film crew at the time. There is I think it's a Pathé news crew who are on their way, I believe, to Royal Ascot, and are diverted there to kind of film the aftermath. Later on, we remember these events later on because they're televised, because we have more photos. Harrow is in that kind of that scary gap between wartime memory and future kind of modern TV and kind of newspaper coverage.
And I suppose also the inclination must have been to put, to put it clumsily, to put sad stuff behind us as a country and move on. You know, we were very much at that point coming out of the darkness that had engulfed us in World War II. So I'm imagining that perhaps a focus on optimism and not dwelling on that sort of stuff might have been prevalent.
Yes, I mean, there's still a kind of a certain amount of kind of keep calm and carry on as this kind of overarching ethos of how you should live your life. But I mean, that still prevails. I mean, 5 years later, you have a similar rail accident at Lewisham, and actually where Harrow has all the luck, Lewisham has none of it. It's a very similar event, it's a very similar accident, but it's further out. There's no kind of response from a similar medical team at that stage, so people die and people kind of and people are lost who at Harrow weren't lost. But what's interesting post Lewisham is there are certain survivors' accounts who left accounts of their treatment afterwards, and there are the walking wounded that walk away from Lewisham. There, I was reading a personal account by a man who wasn't wounded at Lewisham, but helped people out and remove bodies. The police take his name after the accident, and they say, "Okay, here's a ticket to get you home. We'll give you a ring if we need you." There's no this kind of later culture that we build up of really writing these things down and kind of helping survivors of these events. That's not prevalent yet, and it's still not there at Lewisham 5 years later. So it's certainly not there at Harrow.
When an entire city's had the you-know-what bombed out of it just a few years earlier, though, I should think everybody would be entitled to counselling and trauma therapy and to say that they were suffering PTSD, as well they may have been. So, yes, you begin to understand why keeping calm and carrying on is such a pragmatic approach.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that is very much the case at Harrow. It does still form firmly within this kind of this wartime ethos mode, and that's actually, to a certain extent, ends up being to its detriment. One of the things that we struggled with last year for the 60th was coming up with a complete and definitive list of everyone who died, because the records aren't that great, because we're still in a period where there's an expectation of disasters and death. And that causes us issues.
We should finish up. We should touch briefly, finally, on the other repercussions of the Harrow and Wealdstone rail crash, not only in terms of how transport or how rail traffic is handled, but also how patients are handled more widely.
Yeah, I mean, in rail terms, Harrow's quite a big event because one of the things that we kind of take for granted today is that all our kind of rail signalling has something called kind of automatic warning systems built in. These are things that if a driver goes past a signal, they either alert or these days actually stop the train. Back at this time, that's not really prevalent everywhere. And the railway companies are, at the time, were very reluctant to bring that kind of automatic warning systems in, mainly because it was expensive. And also there was a cultural belief amongst the railway companies that if you had good staff and they were doing their jobs, you didn't need these systems. Up until Harrow, every kind of big railway disaster had always been able to be blamed on someone. But the simple fact was that what happened at Harrow, you had very experienced drivers, you had very experienced signalmen, and no fault could be found in any of their actions. It just seemed to be one of those things that just happens. And that really kind of blew out of the water the argument that things like automatic warning systems were a luxury. And that started the process slowly, but it started the process of us transitioning the railways in this country to bring in automatic warning systems wherever they were needed. On the medical side of things, Harrow also has a huge legacy for the NHS, and particularly for the ambulance service. One of the things that the activities carried out by that American medical team on that day really highlight to kind of the other doctors' presence to the NHS staffers watching, that really the kind of the traditional approach of just throwing people into an ambulance and getting them to a hospital as fast as possible wasn't really the correct way. I mean, the actions of the American medical team, they reckon, saved about another 20 lives just by being there and treating people on the platforms. And so that started again the transition in the NHS and in the ambulance service to realizing that what you need in those situations is you need a combat medic on every vehicle. Harrow and Wealdstone effectively marks the birth of the paramedic as a job. That starts really with Harrow.
This feels like the perfect opportunity to give a plug to London's Air Ambulance, which I never tire of supporting. Just in case you don't know, it's paid for entirely by voluntary donations, a little bit of corporate sponsorship, corporate donations, but it also depends on fundraising. So it's one of those things we can't take for granted. And when I was talking to the guys at London's Air Ambulance, they mentioned a similar stroke of magnificent luck on the day of the 7/7 bombings, because as you all know, London's Air Ambulance carries two personnel on board at all times, a doctor and a paramedic, who are able to carry out very advanced forms of surgery on the roadside. And it's exactly that idea that seems to have come from Harrow and Wealdstone, the idea that you bring the medical care to the patient and sort them out there and then, that golden hour idea. And it just so happens that on 7/7 there was a meeting of all of the paramedics and all of the trained doctors, and they were all in the Royal London Hospital at exactly the moment when the bombs went off. And you can only imagine how many lives were saved because of that stroke of luck.
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is very much the kind of the heritage of Harrow, and something that the ambulance services keep going today is this strong and rightful belief that you have to, you don't need to be there doing open heart surgery, but that golden hour is important. And it's not necessarily literally an hour. It's just that sometimes you do need to I think the phrase is stay and play, not scoop and shoot. You know, you do need to do that kind of thing.
Thank you, Gareth Edwards, for being here to talk about this and to perhaps launch Abbey Sweetwine in the consciousness and the memory of the current generation. We should say before we go a word or two about London Reconnections and the sort of stuff you've been involved with. I know you were on the first steam train commemorating 150 years of the Tube earlier this year.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the kind of the pleasures and the luxuries is the ability to kind of wrangle your way onto steam trains at 1 o'clock in the morning and that kind of stuff.
Is it really as early as that?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to be on what was kind of literally the first run, the kind of the final test that was staffed with kind of various people who'd helped out and helped restore the carriages and everything else. So I think there was me, all those people, and a BBC film crew. It was an amazing experience.
What was that like with being surrounded by smoke in the tunnels?
It was very strange. I mean, the big difference was the sound. You don't realise kind of how used to the sound of a regular tube train and a regular station operation you become, and suddenly hearing that kind of that chuffing noise that we associate with steam trains, kind of as you're sitting on one going through the stations, there's a certain kind of does not compute-ness about it. And yeah, when you kind of the station lights and the tunnel lights kind of shrouded in smoke gives them a very kind of an almost kind of Sherlock Holmesian feel.
And what about later on in the year? What's coming up?
There's plenty more talks, and there's a very good poster exhibition just opening at London Transport Museum, which is well worth attending. And there will also be further steam runs in May for those who kind of didn't manage to get on the first time round. Keep an eye on the kind of the London Transport Museum website and all that kind of thing. It's probably also worth mentioning that, of course, the success of the kind of the 150th anniversary tube celebrations has kind of spawned some new ideas about how we do these things going forward. And I know that kind of one of the things that there's various hope now that will happen next year, because obviously next year will be 1914 and it will be the anniversary of the start of the First World War, is to hopefully do something similar with some of the buses that served on the kind of the Western Front. That's something they're in very, very early stages with, and I probably shouldn't be telling you, but I think it's worth sharing.
Well, thank you for sharing, and thank you for sharing your knowledge as regards Harrow and Wealdstone. And just finally, what's your website address so people can check out more of this sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, if you just Google londonreconnections.com, we'll show up as the top link and come over. I mean, as I said, we cover transport news, but also the history and things, everything from Harrow to the history of why those station buildings are red that you see everywhere, and what's special about the typeface that you see on all the stations.
There we go, that's a lovely teaser. Gareth Edwards, thanks very much.
No problem at all.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to my guest Gareth Edwards. Thanks to Matt Keane, Bernie Barkley and Dave Haste. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson, and I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. Inch by inch, waiting for the river's care, straining for the blueing waves calling from the shore.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.